I'm a finishing PhD student. My Viva is next week. I care about content team on ads. But I also care about many other things. I don't know. I care about music, theater, swing dance. Here I am making up a Lindy Hop move. Bouldering, video games, I don't know, many things. But today we'll talk about Codensity team on ads. So just before I get started, is everyone knows what a monad is and what an algebra-for a monad is? Yes? Cool, perfect. So this is the plan for today. I'll tell you what Codensity team on ads are and what properties they satisfy. And then I'll tell you a little bit about distributive laws, which are a sort of device that you can use to combine two different monads to get a new monad, and some relations that come up when you look at distributive laws with codensity monads. But start at the beginning. So this is called the monadic reflection of a functor. I could have also called codensity monads, and you'll see why. Here are some functors and some categories. If you know what a monad is and what algebras for a monad are, then you'll know that each of these functors is monadic, which means that each of these categories are sort of sets equipped with some algebraic structure. And so each of them corresponds to a monad. Here's another functor. Now this one is definitely not monadic for many reasons. For example, if it were monadic, then FinSet would have to be complete. But I mean, it's not. It's a small category. And it's not a pre-order, so. But what if it was, right? Like, can we make it monadic somehow? And how do we make sense of that question? So because of category theorists, it's not enough to have a diagram with categories. We want also a category overall. And here's the category that lives in. So it's the category of categories over set. And its maps are sort of commuting triangles. Now, there's not many maps between these ones, but whatever. And then inside this category, there's a subcategory, which is the one I drew first, which is that of monadic functors. So that's in green. So the question is, what can we make FinSet fit into this smaller subcategory? So that's asking the question, what algebraic theory best approximates finite sets? And I guess more generally, you could do this over any category, not just set. So you'd be asking, right, so monadic functors over a category C include into all functors over that category. When do I have a left adjoint, right? So like a reflection to that inclusion. So what category can I put here? Such that whenever I map from it to these other ones, it's the same thing as mapping from FinSet to those other ones. So if you haven't heard about codensity monads before, you might think, well, surely, like, FinSets, they don't have any algebraic structure. It's just a finite set, right? Like, what could be algebraic about them? So you might struggle to think of something to put here in the monadic section that would even have a map with FinSet. Except, I guess, of course, the identity monad, right? FinSets are sets. But it turns out this question of when does this have a left adjoint has a good answer, and you can always answer it. Basically, what you do is you start with any functor, and then you just ask what is the right kind of extension of that functor G along itself. Now, I said any functor. Really, I mean, this doesn't work. That kind of extension might not always exist. But if it does, for example, if the domain is small and the codomain is complete, then it does. Then that thing exists, and it has a monad structure, which you can build using the universal property of the kind of extension. And so that gives you a monad called TG, and then you take the forgetful functor from the category of algebras for TG, and that is the monadic reflection of your original functor. Okay, so now let's look at some examples, because what does this mean? So a very simple one. Imagine I have the functor from the terminal category to set that just picks out one object, and in particular, the object 2. So the set with two elements. What is its monadic reflection? So if you do this thing with the right kind of extension, what you get the answer is just the double power set monad. So it's like 2 to the 2 to the blank. So it sends a set to the set of collections of subsets of that set. And so the algebras from that MongNet are complete atomic Boolean algebras, which is equivalent to set op by stone duality. And so that's the monadic reflection. Right, the other one, the one I started with, the finite sets into set, what you get is this thing called the ultrafilter monad, which is a super cool monad. It's really ill-behaved in many ways, but its algebras are compact Hausdorff spaces, which, if you haven't heard this before, you should be going like, what? What do you mean? How are those algebras, right? Well, it turns out, you first meet them in topology, but actually they are sets equipped with an algebraic structure. So for every ultrafilter on that set, you choose where it converges to. And that's just what it means to be a compact Hausdorff space. So if we think about what that means in our context, that says that the algebras that are most closely related to finite sets are compact Hausdorff spaces. Another way to think about it is like we've just done some kind of category theory magic that has produced the category of compact Hausdorff spaces from just the category of finite sets. Yeah, question? 1 second.
Is G here supposed to be the forgetful functor?
Yeah, it's the inclusion of finite sets into
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, forgetting that it's finite. So that's that. Some variants that you could do with this. So here I put an asterisk next to algebraic theory because there's many things you could mean by algebraic theory. One of those is you could mean a finitary algebraic theory. So if you just talk about monads on set, those basically correspond to infinitary single-sorted algebraic theories, and so we could ask the same question: what if I wanted a finitary theory? So everyone happy with finitary versus infinitary? So like groups and rings have finitary operations because you multiply two things, which is a finite number. But then you could have something like a soup lattice where you can take a supremum of an arbitrary large set. So that's an infinitary operation. You could only remember the finitary operations. And then if you took the same examples from the previous slide and you took the inclusion of the set 2 into set, then the theory you would get is that of all Boolean algebras, not just complete atomic ones. And if you took finite sets into sets, then you would just get sets again. There's no the finitary operations of that theory are just the identity ones. Another example, so far over set, you could do it over other categories. For example, if you take fields into commutative rings and you ask what is the algebraic theory that corresponds to that, it turns out that its algebras are products of fields in this kind of weird so it's a free product completion. Another version is you could talk about so this is the finite co-product completion of a category, and this is the whole co-product completion. So in some sense, it's like a categorification of the finite sets into sets thing. And then what you end up with is called the ultra-product monad, and it has to do with sheaves and compact Hausdorff spaces, but we won't get into that. But just so that you can see, like very quickly, you start with sort of simple things, and you get cool, complicated things out of this process, which again is just taking a Rankine extension of a functor along itself. Okay, so maybe now you're curious about quantity monads, but do you care about them? So when you talk about quantity monads, somebody usually question.
So are you considering the size criteria of a set as just like a one category, or some like high category, high categorical things you can do to say this like a two reflection or something?
Just one category.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you can try to do it to categories, but then it doesn't quite work. Like the natural transformations. Yeah, we can talk about it later.
Yes. Just now, did we find like a sort of monadic structure on finite set, on fin set to set now, or are we still not there yet?
So it's compact. I guess it's this diagram. I guess.
Okay. So basically, that's the answer.
Yeah, that is the answer. These are the algebras that most look like finite sets.
How does that work exactly?
Like, okay.
It's a bit complicated, but so what it means is that if I have any other monadic category of a set, like groups, and I had a functor from finite sets to groups, which there isn't, not one over set, you can't have that, but say you did, then that would give you a unique functor from compact house of spaces to groups.
Okay, so we can say that finances are kind of like compact house of spaces.
Yeah,
okay.
A little bit.
Okay, thank you.
So every monad is a currency monad, because you could just take the functor that's the forgetful functor from the category of host. Another question.
I have another question regarding the first example with the functor from the terminal category.
This one.
So the double power set monad, it sounds to me kind of like the continuation monad over the set of two elements.
Oh yeah, 100%.
And the continuation monad you can define over any Cartesian closed category. Do you get the same result?
Any Cartesian. So yeah, you can change the set 2 to any other set, and then you get the endomorphism monad or continuation monad.
Yeah.
Over other things than set, other than set, probably not, because like you might have to do an enriched version of this. Because you'll get like a power to a set instead of to the internal HOM if you just do the normal can extension.
Okay.
But if you do the enriched one, because if you're Cartesian closed, you can enrich over yourself, then you should get the continuation monad.
Yes.
I mean, don't quote me on that, but I think that's how it would work. Anyway, any other questions? One more.
So we've seen that this constraint of being compact and Hausdorff just pops up like this. Is this kind of why when you do topology, so when we work with like more L-behaved spaces like T1 and lower regularity, it's like really complicated and we don't really know much about it. But then when we get T2, then we can actually like do stuff.
Yeah.
Is it this?
Yes and no. I mean, this only really tells you something about compact Hausdorff spaces. If you this is like a cheap way of getting that fact that, you know, a continuous bijection between compact Hausdorff spaces is a homeomorphism.
I mean,
because they're algebras, right? So I just need a bijective homeomorphism. So this tells you some very nice things about compact Hausdorff spaces. Mm. But you can't really like decouple the compact and the Hausdorff in this context. I
mean, yeah.
You'll have to actually go do topology for that.
I have another question.
Yeah?
Yeah. So basically, the complete atomic Boolean algebra category is kind of like set up.
Yeah, that's right.
So I'm like thinking, is also fin set up like compact Hausdorff spaces, or is not related really?
I see what you mean. No, I think that's a coincidence. You'll need some kind of duality setting. Like something similar happens when you take like finite dimensional vector spaces into vector spaces.
Yeah.
And you get something that is equivalent to vect op.
Okay.
But in general, there isn't.
It's just a coincidence here.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Yes, continue. So I was saying, every monad is a currency monad, so sure, I care about currency monads because I care about monads. But somehow that misses a bit the point. So instead of thinking about currency monads, we should think about the process of constructing currency monads as a way to present a monad. So it's like, you know, if you know about groups, you when you write a presentation for what a group is, you just use a couple of operations. You don't give the whole monad, then that's kind of derived from the presentation you gave. And so really we should be thinking of a functor that induces a codensity monad as a presentation for that monad. And some presentations are nicer than others. And today, I guess one of the points I'm going to be pushing is that if you have the codensity monad of a fully faithful functor, that's a very nice presentation, because it will tell us, think about the monad. So what are some possible nice presentations? Well, the first one is when you have a right adjoint. That's really boring, because then the codensity monad is just the monad induced by the adjunction. The other one is the one I just spoiled, sorry. So a fully faithful functor. So when you have a fully faithful functor, then you get this nice thing where like the category you started with is a full subcategory of the category of algebras. So for FinSet is a full subcategory of compact hash spaces. When you're talking about like normal right adjoints, that's something like being of descent type. But here it's just because it comes for free. And so today I want to tell you about when you start with a fully faithful functor that induces a codensity monad, then that can tell you something about what distributive laws exist under the corresponding codensity monad. So in I guess our running example of finite sets and compact hash spaces, it's going to tell us about how we can combine the ultrafilter monad with other monads on set. But I'm not assuming that you know what a distributive law is. So I'll quickly tell you. So one thing with monads is they don't compose. So if I have two monads, I can form the composite endo functor, but that won't have a monad structure. I mean, I can come up with what the unit would have to be, but then what's the multiplication, right? Kind of run out of things to use. One thing that I could try is, well, if I could somehow stop in the middle, then I can use the multiplication of each of the other two monads. But still, like, how do I get there? And the answer is using a distributive law. So this is a really old definition from the 60s by Beck. So a distributive law is going to be a natural transformation from ST to TS. We're going to sandwich there. And it has to satisfy some compatibility conditions, which, I mean, they sort of relate the units and the multiplication of the two monads. Don't worry too much about it. It's kind of the conditions you need for the thing to work. So the reason the distributive laws are important is that we have this theorem, which says that having a distributive law is the same thing as these two other things. Let me start with three, so because that was the motivation, I guess. It's a monad structure on the composite TS. Not just any monad structure, one that's particularly nicely related to TNS, but we won't get into that. And the other thing that it's equivalent to is to have a lift of the monad T to the category of algebras for the monad S. And when I say a lift, I mean, you know, a monad on CS that sort of, under the forgetful functor, just looks like the original monad T. So the most well-known example of distributive laws and the thing that gives us the name distributive law is if you start with the free monoid monad on set and the free abelian group monad on set, then there's the distributive law of multiplication over addition. And this is the usual equation you have, right, in, I don't know, in primary school. And that's what the distributive law does, right? I take a monoid word of abelian group words, and I produce an abelian group word of monoid words. Okay. So if I look at this theorem, and I look at number two, I have this lift along a monadic functor. But if you remember the first part of the talk, we had a way of converting any functor into a monadic one. So what if I change number two to be a lift along an arbitrary functor, not just a monadic one? And does this give us anything about one and three? So that's going to be the last part. So consider the following situation. This is just like the setup, right? So I have a functor G whose codensity monad is S. And then I have some other monad on the codomain T, and I have a lift of T along G, which I'm calling T bar. So the theorem we just saw gives us a sort of bijections between all of these things. Here we're interested in having a lift along G instead. So we're going to try to fill in this arrow. Now it's dashed because we can't really do it always, but sometimes we can. And so I'll tell you when. So let's look at, so these two are sort of the most similar. So let's look at what this arrow does so that it might inform us how to define that arrow. So if I do have a lift along the forgetful functor, the monadic one, then the way I can get a composite monad on the base category is just, well, so I have my original adjunction coming from the monad S, and now I have a lift, so I have a monad T bar on CS, so I have another adjunction. And so I just compose the two adjunctions. I get a bigger junction that induces a monad. So no surprises there. Now, what happens on the other side? So if I just have a lift along the functor g, then we can take something that is called a push forward of t bar along g. And this is what my thesis is about. So I can tell you a lot of things about push forwards if you're interested later. But it's defined a little bit like Cohen City monads. So what you do is you take the Rankine extension L on G of G, but now you compose with a lift of T. And so this also has a canonical monad structure. And in fact, it's the same thing as the Cohen City monad of this composition. So really, I guess it's nothing new. Okay. So what about that? So now I've added this push forward here to the diagram, which I then noticed looks like a key, which I think is very cute. Right, so this push forward, this right-hand extension of GT bar along G is a monad. And I want to argue that it's a combination of T and S in some way. However, it might not be the composite of T and S, because I mean, we just took a kind of extension. There's no reason why it should be. Nevertheless, we have some monad maps. And so if you don't know what a monad map is, just think of it as a map going the other way between the categories of algebras. So it's kind of like, I guess, the theory of monoids maps into the theory of groups. And so I get a forgetful functor from groups to monoids. So there's canonical transformations like this. Now, for these two, the things on both sides are monads, so I can ask for them to be monad maps, and they are. So that's given. This one, well, TS is not a monad, so what's a monad map? But if TS was a monad, and how do I make TS a monad? I get a distributive law. Then this will also be a monad map as soon as that distributive law is sort of compatible in some sense with our context, with that key diagram. Compatible just means that this thing commutes. So here, epsilon is the co-unit of the Cohen extension. These things are equalities because I asked for a strict lift. But actually, you can have a lift after isomorphism. That's fine. But anyway, well, so we need if we have this compatibility condition, then the composite monad induced by this distributive law will have a monad map into the push forward. Now, why do we need this condition? Well, if we think about what Cohen City monads are, they're sort of presentations for monads. And so we shouldn't expect that any distributive law will sort of play nicely with a given presentation. So there is a condition that we need. I mean, if anything, to make the lemma work. However, this very nice thing happens, which is when G is fully faithful, the functor that you're taking the Cohen City monad off, then any distributive law will be compatible with this thing. So that's one of the reasons that it's very nice. So just, I guess, the last thing. So here's the theorem. Again, in the same key diagram. So we saw that there was a map here, a natural transformation. If it's monic, then there's going to be a unique distributive law that's compatible in the sense from the previous slide, if and only if the monad structure of this, the push-forward monad, restricts along this monic natural transformation. And restricts means that sort of if I start with things here and I do the multiplication or I do the unit, then I also land there. I mean, explicitly, it's that thing at the bottom. So that's nice. But of course, it has this compatible part. So if we just take a fully faithful functor, then we can get rid of that because any distributive law will be compatible. And so then here's a corollary of that. So if T, the monad on C, preserves this right-hand extension, then certainly this will be monic. It will be an isomorphism. Anything will restrict along it because it's an isomorphism. And so we'll get a unique distributive law of that form. So OK, this is a lot. Let me give you some examples to finish. So let's look at finite sentence set. It's fully faithful. And so now I just need to find monads that lift to finite sets, which in this case just means that they send finite sets to finite sets, and that preserve the Rankine extension. And so a big family, well, I don't know how big, but a nice family of such monads are polynomial monads on set, which preserve finiteness. So then the theorem will tell us that there'll be a unique distributed law of the ultrafilter monad over any such monad. The reason why I want the polynomial ones is because they preserve connected limits, and the way you compute this kind of extension is using cofilter ones, which are connected. So you get that. So some examples, in case you don't know what a polynomial monad is one that looks like a polynomial. So imagine the blank is an x, and the other things are numbers. All of these are polynomials. So these are sort of, I guess, famous in computer science. They have computer science-y names. So for each of those monads, there's a unique distributed law of the ultrafilter monad over these. And that you just sort of get that from the fact that the ultrafilter monad is presented by this fully faithful functor. Now, there was an if and only if in the theorem, so you can also use this to show that there's no distributed loss in some cases. And so in particular, you can show that there's no distributed law of the ultrafilter monad over the finite power set monad, because just by showing that the monad structure doesn't restrict along the map. And then, this is, I guess, it's an example of something else, of a generalization, if you will. So there's also something called weak distributed laws, which some people care about, and you can play the same game with those. It suddenly becomes a lot messier. But you can actually recover some cool stuff, like, so there's this famous weak distributed law of the ultrafilter monad over the power set monad, and you can recover it using this sort of trickier version, using weak distributed laws of this story. And that's everything. So takeaways, any functor that's nice enough will give you a monad. It's code density monad, and you can think of it as a presentation of that monad. If the functor is fully faithful, then that's a very nice presentation, because then it will tell you about the existence and uniqueness of certain distributive laws under the corresponding code density monad. And yeah, I think that's everything. Here's some references. Thank you for listening.
Thanks, Adrian. So let's just do one quick question, and then you can just catch Adrian in the break, because please, now we have a lunch break. Yay!
Why is it called a codensity monad?
So do you know what a dense functor is? So a dense functor is one, when you take the left-hand extension of it along itself, you get the identity. A codense functor is one when you take the right-hand extension. And so a codense functor is just one whose codensity monad is the identity. And so I guess the codensity monad is a measure of the failure of density, of codensity. It's not a great name, is it?
I mean, if you know what a dense functor is,
maybe, even then. Anyway, okay, so that's good. Let's go to lunch.
Yes, let's go to lunch. Thank you.